Let's just move on now and talk about immunotherapy, metastatic disease, and what's coming now in the future, Mike. And here's a summary of some of the things that you covered in your talk. Maybe you can just sort of chat your way through these in terms of some of these key issues that are up right now in terms of immunotherapy, Mike.
Sure. So within the past year, we saw the five-year follow-up data from the CheckMate 067 study, which compared Nivo-Ipi to Nivo-Ipi in patients with metastatic melanoma. And we saw that at 5 years, there's 52% of patients on the Nivo-Ipi arm are still alive. And that's about a 8% difference compared to the Nivo monotherapy arm, and almost making it to statistical significance, with the hazard ratio being 1.03 at the top 95% confidence interval. The difference was particularly profound between Nivo-Ipi and Nivo monotherapy in patients who were BRAF mutant, where there was about a 14% difference in those tail of those survival curves. And I tend to look at the, when people say the Nivo-Ipi is more toxic, I tend to look at the tail of those survival curves, and the difference between the tail of those survival curves at 5 years is grade five toxicity related to not giving the best therapy. And so I think the toxicity of treatment is a lot easier to deal with than the toxicity of disease progression. I think the other question that comes out from...
Before you go on, Mike, could you just comment on this slide here?
And I was going to go into it. Yeah.
Yeah, go ahead. Sorry, go ahead.
So who are the patients who I think should get combination therapy versus single agent? And so I tend to give combination therapy to most patients, but the type of patients who I think for sure you should consider combination Nivo-Ipi for as opposed to single agent are those who have a higher performance status, an elevated LDH, more advanced disease, stage 4 C or D with the AJCC stage 8, version 8 staging system. Patients who can tolerate autoimmune toxicities. If they had steroids, they wouldn't get into horrible trouble. And then other things that I take into consideration are BRAF mutation. If you have a PD-L1 test and they're PD-L1 negative, we usually don't get a PD-L1 test, but community oncologists tend to get that because they treat lung cancer. And so that tends to come back for those patients, and they get the same thing for melanoma. Patients with mucosal or aqueal primaries, as we talked about before, who have less immunogenic tumors, and certainly someone who's had a prior adjuvant treatment, a prior BRAF MEK inhibitor in the adjuvant setting would be someone I'd give a combination for. Some of the newer stuff that we're seeing are combinations that use less Ipi, either two doses of Ipi, and there was data presented by Mike Pastow that seemed to suggest that you could get away with two doses of Ipi and have the same efficacy with combination Nivo-Ipi, and other studies which looked at lower doses of Ipi, such as the regimen used in kidney cancer, where you give full dose anti-PD-1 and a lower dose of Ipi, where you can see PFS and overall survival. And in the Pembro Ipi study that Georgina led in Australia, had a tail on the overall survival curve at 3 years at 73% with toxicity that was about two-thirds of the toxicity of a full-dose regimen.
Georgina, any comments on Ipi-Nivo? Also about PD-L1 levels. I always thought it made a lot of sense to look at PD-L1 levels, and yet when we talk to melanoma people, they don't even order them. Any comments, Georgina?
Yeah, we started the PD-L1, the whole field, but now we don't use it. And the reason is because if it's PD-L1 negative, you still have a good 25-30% chance of responding to anti-PD-1 alone. So it's not a very highly sensitive or specific test to pick out PD-L1 monotherapy. And that's where it's really used in lung cancer. We're talking PD-1 monotherapy. So we haven't then transferred that to combination therapy. I guess it's useful when you've got a patient who lives far away who may not be as well supported and you're and they've got bad disease, particularly liver and bone mets. We know they need CTLA-4 as well. We've done a study looking at that in over 800 metastases. So site of metastases also matters. So in general, in summary, in the clinic, we use the combination, as Mike said, with high volume disease, bad disease, rapidly progressing disease, liver mets, bone mets, brain mets, and we don't use PD-L1 clinically. We look at the patient as they walk through the door, look at their scan, look at the patient, and that's what informs us about our decisions. And talk Jason, to the patient.
Jason, any comments again on some of these points that Mike brought up about ipi-nivo and also this two-dose ipi approach too? That we saw a paper in lung cancer that got a lot of excitement as well. How do you use ipi-nivo specifically, Jason?
Well, I would agree with what all my colleagues have said so far in terms of how we would select the patients for using ipi and nivo. It's really, it's really the clinical phenotype that we, you know, stratify as opposed to any kind of molecular biomarker. To the question about the number of doses of nivo and ipi to give, I found that the presentation from Sloan Kettering quite profound, actually. I think we need more data before we completely change the way we do things, but I have sort of been biased towards less is more with using nivo and ipi, so that data to me sort of validated some observations in my practice around patients who have toxicity, where I don't rush to go back and retreat them because it really certainly seems like most of the benefit is coming from the very beginning, the first pop, the first couple of doses. I think a more robust study that's more than just 70 or 80 patients of what it was really would be necessary to really change practice. But I think we can reassure patients that if they have to stop, they're likely to benefit long term from the therapy.
So,
Neil, may I just make a comment on that? Sorry, but I just have to make a comment on dosing. So it's very important. There are two things we're talking about here. One is using the 3 mg/kg ipi and just stopping if they get a tox or only giving two doses, or reducing the dose as they do in kidney cancer and other cancers. There is a dose response curve in CTLA-4, particularly for BRAF mutant patients. We know that. So I'm a little hesitant with the data of 1 mg/kg of ipi versus 3 mg. The only randomized data we have is from 511, a clinical trial, but it wasn't powered for efficacy. So the efficacy question in terms of lower dose of ipi is not answered. And as Mike said, we have great large numbers of patients with 1 mg of ipi that seem to do well with lower toxicity, but we don't have a proper efficacy trial. And I know with BRAF mutant patients, there is a dose response curve, meaning more CTLA-4, better response. So we do have to be careful, which is why I like the approach of you use the full dose and stop early if they get tox and you're seeing a response like the POSTAL data. But that's important to be aware of.
Yeah, that's a really great point. Mike, you had this slide in your talk, and maybe you can just comment on that in terms of your approach to immunotherapy and melanoma.
Sure. Well, I think this was with regard to a discussion about what to do in someone who had progressed after adjuvant immunotherapy and what should you give them. And in the metastatic setting, I still think my goal right now has been this way since I was giving high-dose IL-2 back in the 1980s and 1990s is to try to cure the patient. And I think we still have a very good chance of doing that and still have that opportunity, even in patients who have had progression after anti-PD-1. So whether that progression is on treatment or within 6 months or even after 6 months after stopping treatment, I still think that what you give to someone who has progressed on a single agent anti-PD-1 appears to be a nivo-ipi combination. And the data from the University of Chicago in the study that Jason was involved in suggests that nivo-ipi after progression on anti-PD-1 in the metastatic setting has about a 27% response rate with a real CR rate of somewhere in the 10% range. Georgina presented data from the study of pembrolizumab versus ipilimumab in patients with metastatic melanoma and took the pembrolizumab progressing patients and gave them ipilimumab and saw a real response rate in that setting of ipi of 13%, but not the 27% that you see with ipi-nivo or ipi-pembro. And then there was a study in Australia, which was retrospective, with also showed about a 30% response rate for combination CTLA-4 anti-PD-1 blockade versus about 15% for CTLA-4 alone after progression on anti-PD-1. And there will be a SWOG study, which will be coming out soon, that formally compares CTLA-4 anti-PD-1 versus CTLA-4 alone in patients who progress on single agent anti-PD-1. And so until we see the results of that study based on the limited data we have from the various other studies that have been presented, I would give nivo-ipi in patients who progressed after single-agent anti-PD-1.
So, Jason, quick question from the audience. To overcome immune resistance, and any role for IL-2 receptor agonists or adding TGF-beta inhibitors?
A theoretical role, not really adequately explored to think that that would be useful in clinic as yet. There are drugs trying to attack those pathways that may or may not become relevant in the future, but certainly not something that would be, you know, at the tip of the tongue. That would be more of an early phase clinical trial participation sort of question.
So, Mike, any comments in terms of new developments and particularly novel combinations for us to look forward to in terms of melanoma?
Yeah, there's some big studies now going on based on phase one and phase two studies looking at nivolumab plus the Nektar-214, which is their pegylated IL-2, and also a study looking at nivolumab plus anti-LAG-3. I think we were all very excited at the first data looking at the PEG IL-2 plus anti-PD-1s because it seemed like there was a high response rate, particularly in patients who were PD-L1 negative and also seen in lung cancer, kidney cancer. But as we've looked at that data and as it matured, it's become less clear that that result was not just from the anti-PD-1 alone at specialized centers. And we would like to see a single agent activity with an agent that we're combining with an anti-PD-1 and efficacy in patients who've progressed after PD-1 failure with the combination of anti-PD-1 and that new agent. And we just don't see that yet with the Nektar-214. So it's hard to be really confident that that phase 3 trial is going to show a major difference. LAG-3 is different because there is activity with anti-PD-1 plus LAG-3 in patients who've progressed after anti-PD-1, particularly in the subset of about 30 to 50% of patients who express LAG-3 on their T cells, and where the response rate may be as high as 20%. And so we'll see whether that translates into more activity than anti-PD-1 monotherapy in the front line. But even if it does, I doubt that that activity is going to be better than CTLA-4 blockade plus anti-PD-1.
So I want to close with your visions for the future, let's say the near future, next 2 or 3 years. What do you think maybe is going to be coming into practice, new strategies? Georgina, what's happening that you're excited about?
Well, I have to say I'm excited about the neoadjuvant space because in a short space of 6 weeks, we can assess any doublet, triplet, and tell you whether it's going to reach that bar that we currently have. And there are some exciting molecules that we're looking at. Particularly some of the VEGF molecules.
Yeah, you were mentioning that to me. I didn't realize that VEGF has a whole history in melanoma.
Yeah, serum VEGF is correlated with prognosis. I think VEGF has a role in a lot of cancers, vessels, blood vessels, cancer growth. But yeah, watch this space and we'll see how it transpires.
Jason, you can maybe let you close with your thoughts about the future of melanoma. What are some of the things that you think are most exciting? What are we going to be doing in our practice 2 or 3 years from now, Jason?
Well, I think, as we've mentioned, BRAF and MEK have a role. Whether or not those triplets really make a dent, I'm not sure. But CTLA-4 and PD-1 is going to be very hard to beat in the front line. And I would quickly just mention that there are things coming for refractory disease, such as the use of tumor-infiltrating lymphocytes and some other molecules like toll-like receptor 9 agonists that I think could impact on subsequent lines of therapy over the next couple of years.
So again, I invite you to check out the three presentations. There were a couple cases we wanted to go through today, but they're all dealt with in detail in these presentations. Thank you all for attending. Be safe, stay well, and have a great day.